Hi, everybody.
Blog Talk Radio.
Oops, I guess I beat that to the punch. Hi, everybody. It's Kelly Connors, and I'm host here of Real Women on Health, and our series is on Design the Second Half of Your Life, or, God willing, third or fourth act of your life. that's what the show is going to be all about today. I have a wonderfully irreverent and, self-radicalized Ashton Applewhite here, and she's going to talk to us today about three ways to combat ageism and live well. And she has a wonderful blog that is so inspiring called This Chair Rocks, soon to become a book available. But I was just talking to Ashton, and she said, why don't you start off by talking a little bit about your own experience, which I'm happy to do because it's really so it's so in my face every day. And once I turned 50, it seemed as though everything was fine. I was still 30 in my own mind. But something about 55, 56 kind of creeps up on you, and you kind of have this peek into, well, you know, that means you're almost 60, and that means you're almost dead. So it's kind of like moving the timeline forward, and you think you absolutely have no time to live your life. And actually, it did happen. This kind of thinking did happen to me much earlier than in my 50s. I remember thinking in my early 40s, oh, I better get on with my career and make everything happen quick before, you know, I get too old and nothing can be done. So that kind of mindset is just so destructive. It's not only destructive to us as individuals, as women, as leaders in our community, but it's also socially really destructive to the economy. We are the ones that are really leading the way, okay? So before I get too much into it, I'm going to introduce Ashton. She's just wonderful. She's recognized by the New York Times, the National Public Radio, and the American Society on Aging as an expert in ageism. She speaks widely and blogs at thischairrocks.com, and she is the voice of Yo, Is This Ageist? Beautiful. She's written for Harper's, Playboy, The Huffington Post, and Generations, the Journal of the American Society of Aging. And really wonderfully, in 2015, she was included in Salt Magazine's list of 100 inspiring women, along with some names I actually can't pronounce, the first one being Korean. But anyways, Angelina Jolie, Germaine Greer, Naomi Klein, and other remarkable activists who are committed to social change. So welcome to the show, Ashton, and I can't wait to hear about how you got started and what are the three ways. Well, we'll have a conversation about it to combat ageism.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I think maybe it would be a good idea to start with a definition of ageism, which it's amazing how many people really don't know what it is, even though they, you know, they figure out, well, I know what racism is, I know what sexism. So by analogy, ageism is discrimination on the basis of age, but it really exists anytime we make any assumption about what a person is like or what they're interested in or what they're capable of on the basis of their age. And all isms, all discrimination is based on stereotyping, right? You turn this group into something other and alien, and you say it has this set of characteristics. And, of course, stereotyping is always not just wrong but false, because, no, you know, you can never – there's no group of which every member is identical, but especially when it comes to age, because as we get older, the more different from one another we become. Geriatricians have a saying that if you've seen one 80-year-old, you've seen one 80-year-old. So
right.
If you think, as an example, like those marketing boxes, you know, where they sell things, you know, are you 17 to 23 or 24 to 36 or whatever, they end at 65, as though everyone over 65 does the same thing and buys the same stuff. Now, those people, which is us, they're not them, they're me. We're going to live 30 more years. Imagine making the same assumption about a group of people from 30 to 60. Ridiculous.
Right. It's just unbelievable that we would think, I mean, I take a look at it. You're right, some 80-year-old people are, they're not all on walkers and sitting alone in nursing homes. They're very vibrant.
Absolutely
parts
not.
Of the community.
Well, you asked what got me started on this, and the nursing home made me think of it. I started working on a project about people over 80 who work, because I realized that I was at the time in my mid-50s, I'm 63 now, and I was thinking about aging as you are, and I was scared stiff. And I thought, well, work will be, you know, a sort of safe, neutral, positive way into this area. And I started interviewing people over 80 who work, who were a dime a dozen. You can find them everywhere. And one of the things, my assumption was, you know, most older people end up in nursing homes. The percentage
right.
of Americans over 65, 65 to 105 in nursing homes is 4%, down from 5% in the last decade.
Wow.
I also assumed that, right? You know, I also assumed that old people were depressed because they were old and they were going to die soon. And it turns out that older people enjoy better mental health than the young or the middle-aged because the aging process itself confers coping strategies on the brain. You know, these are not real Buddhists, you know, or billionaires, ordinary people. It's why if you Google U-shaped happiness curve, you will see data from, it's the best corroborated data I have, that people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. And I thought, why didn't I know any of this stuff? Why is everything
right.
I thought I knew about aging wrong? And it's because we live in a society that discriminates against older people, that treats us like second-class citizens, and that hasn't even begun to be examined. And it is time.
Oh, absolutely. Now, when you talk about the fact that people are happiest at the beginning and the ends of their lives in that U-shaped curve, that means that people who are at the end of their lives are happy. And to what do you ascribe that to? You said coping mechanisms, but is
it actually a change? It is. It's really, really interesting. I mean, one of the many ageist assumptions that I made, you know, when I started out all this on this, was one of the reasons that old people must be depressed is because they are closer to dying. And that, the, you know, as the shadow, this is in my imagination, you know, the shadow of the Grim Reaper gets closer, you must get more
right.
and more flipped out. It works exactly the other way. The older people are, the less afraid of dying. I heard it anecdotally, I heard it from doctors, and then I found studies about it. So every single fact I am letting you guys know about is on my blog, This Chair Rocks, which is searchable. Enter any term, you can find the data behind this. It turns out that the knowledge that time is short does not fill people with dread. It makes them spend their time more wisely, right? And it's why when we are caught up in at a minor level, you know, buying anti-ageism products and pretending that somehow we can stop the clock. And at an extreme level, you know, these people who believe that we're going to, you know, cure aging as though A, it were curable, and B, it were a disease, neither of which is the case. It's the fact that life is finite that gives it meaning and that enables us to live in the moment, which is how children live. And that is what the awareness that time is growing short towards the end does at the end of life, and that is why people are happiest in childhood and at the ends of their lives.
I'm sorry. It takes a certain amount of, which we don't have right now, we're in denial. So that acceptance, the pathway that leads to acceptance.
But it also
it
happens to most people. Right,
yeah.
It is a function of the aging process. That's the other thing. And also, it's independent of class. It's not just if you're rich. It's not just,
right.
I mean, obviously, money helps a lot, and social class has an enormous, you know, role to play in how above all, how healthy we can keep ourselves. But this result obtains across class, across countries, across marital status, because aging itself confers benefits. I mean, let's think, I don't know how old your listeners are, but we are brainwashed from birth to believe that the 20s are your best decades, right? And it's basically downhill from that, especially if you're a female, in which point you might as well shoot yourself if you're still single at 30 or if you have any, you know, extra flesh anywhere on your body or if you don't have, you know, a husband, whatever. And yet, as we go through life, I mean, I don't know about you, but turning 40 was pretty great and turning 50 was pretty great. And I am thoroughly enjoying being in my 60s, which is not to say that there aren't aspects of aging that are difficult and challenging. That's real. But there are also genuine benefits. And the real overarching point here is that the social message that it's all downhill is just plain wrong, right? It's not, it
right.
is not a process of decline. Aging means living. We are aging from the day we are born.
Yeah,
you can
that's,
no
that's
more
right. It, this is a, such
right?
a mind shift, a perspective change. And don't you have research that shows that, you know, this whole, you know, discrimination practice, it's actually our own mindset about ages,
yeah.
about getting old is actually getting rid of the joy and the health benefits that come
right.
from
if
a more positive mindset.
Yeah, if you're stuck in denial, for one thing, think about the sort of how weird it is that we celebrate the ability to adapt to circumstance and to change and grow through life until we hit whatever this magic point is where you might go from, you know, youngness to oldness and everything will start to suck. And how bizarre, and then, so then the goal becomes to keep everything the same, right?
Right.
To keep your face the same, to keep your body the same, to keep your career the same. That's crazy. I mean, it's not achievable. And any time you set yourself a goal that can't possibly be achieved, you set yourself up for misery. But also, it's not a good way to go through life. I think what you're referring to is really, really interesting research that shows that people's attitude towards aging has a measurable effect on how our minds and bodies function.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because they have done the study that always sticks with me is they took two bunches of college students and they primed them, which means they sat them in front of computers and flashed a subliminal message. It's too fast for the people to be consciously aware of it. And one people got, you know, no messages. And the other was primed with negative messages about aging, words like Florida and bingo and dementia, right?
Mm.
And at the conclusion of the experiment, the students who had been primed with the negative messages about aging walked to the elevator more slowly than the other group.
Yes.
Right? And that's
these
are well before the age of, you know, of any of these stereotypes actually coming true. So they do become, we live in a society that is filled with all these negative messages, where the other side of the story, which is frankly the factual side of the story, it's much more nuanced, you know, is not heard. And so, I mean, a little example is, you know, blaming an ache on being 63. Well, does your other knee hurt? It's 63 too.
Right? I mean, exactly.
You know, maybe your back hurts. Well, could that have to do with the fact that, you know, you moved some furniture yesterday and that the person younger than you who also helped you move the furniture could be stiff also? We reflexively blame things on age.
It's so true.
Right?
It's so true. Yeah. And I get such relief when somebody 20 years younger than me forgets something. And
no
then
kidding.
I say, they forget stuff too. And it's
exactly. Well, when you forgot the keys in high school, did you call it a junior moment?
Right, right. That kind of is just, I mean, if you really know, we noticed that.
It's a, and another, you know, so the very, you know, the biggest ask I would make of your listeners is to do exactly what you described at the beginning of this conversation, which is to look at your own attitude towards age and aging. And that's hard because we are all biased. You know, and it's very unpleasant to realize, like, oh, shoot, I have been, you know, held sort of captive by these ideas that I didn't really think through. But that's when you start to realize, oh, you know, whoa, like, you know, I'm 40 and guess what? I'm still having sex, or I am more into whatever your area of interest is than ever, or I have new areas of competence to draw on. Or for women in particular, we talk about gaining confidence in our later years, right? And starting to throw off this sense that we have to conform physically and socially to some like way that women should be and to come into our own with this fantastic sense of personal power. You know, so those are real too. So is your view of late life realistic or not? Right? And think about the language that you use. And think about, think about whether your attitudes are going to fulfill negative prophecies about old age or not. Because if you have a more accurate view of late life, which means inherently a more positive one, you are going to age better because even at a minimum, you're going to take better care of yourself. There is really, really interesting research that shows that even people who were totally sharp, when they have looked at their brains after their death, they are filled with Alzheimer's-type plaque and tangles.
Yes.
And what distinguishes those people who were functioning cognitively just fine is that they were engaged. They had some kind of purpose in life, whether it was to beat their next-door neighbor at bridge or to see their kid graduate from college or to make the world safe to grow old in, whatever it is. And if we think that late life is going to be an interesting time where we can continue to contribute and do interesting things and have fun, then of course you're going to stay engaged in the world, and that in turn is going to make your late life interesting. It's going to help you, you know, stay socially engaged, which is really important. Super important to make and keep friends of all ages.
Yeah, diversity. A diverse social circle is so important. It's so important. It really alleviates your because you're right there with people younger, older, and realizing there's some common things that, you know, there's some things that
exactly.
we have in common and not, you know,
exactly.
separate. We're not so separate.
I mean, an age is just, it's not a, you know, it's, I mean, unless your thing happens to be some kind of extreme sport, which, you know, frankly, our bodies do not continue to be capable of, if you're interested in a set of ideas, in an author, in gardening, in your dog, in butterflies, in whatever it happens to be, people of all ages are interested in those things.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
No?
People at different ages
have things to learn from each other, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's the biggest challenge is, especially I'll talk from a workplace perspective now, is that I think that the management of companies, and I used to be one of them, so I can kind of say this, that we do look at age as a discriminating factor, and we don't talk about it. But it certainly is, and I think, you know, one of the things that's just apparent now is that the economy is doing better, but it's only doing better in certain areas, and only certain people are getting hired.
But we're talking, you know, service economy, where older people can absolutely contribute. They're not inherently areas where older people, you know, are not. I mean, there's no area in which older people are not as qualified to contribute as people of as any other age, unless it involves heavy lifting. And not that much work involves heavy lifting anymore, because we have machines to do that now.
Right.
But I think it's what I say around workplace diversity is, how come when you think about diversity, most people say, well, of course, that means racial diversity and sexual orientation. We need men and women, and then they stop. And I say, why isn't age a criterion for diversity?
Yeah, it should.
And they say,
yeah.
I didn't think of that. You're right, it should be. So the next time you're in a room where everyone is the same age, unless there's a really good reason, ask why.
Yeah. Ask why people are, that we don't have representation from a more diverse
ask
segment.
Why? Why aren't there some young people or old people? And remember, age discrimination cuts both ways. Every time you know, you think that a young person doesn't have anything to teach you, or you know, wouldn't have enough experience to you know, lend anything of value, that's ageism too.
Yeah.
Anytime you make any assumption about someone on the basis of age. So it's really important to, you know, to check your bias. And when you are in a situation that's ageist, or, you know, where you think ageism might be operational, you know, say something, not in an aggressive way, but just ask the question. I mean, people say, well, what should I say when someone says something ageist to me? And the only really good snappy answer I've come up with is when someone says, you look great for your age, which should be a compliment and is often intended as one, except in a society where we're supposed to be embarrassed about being old, which is, of course, the underlying problem, your age is being called out and everyone feels a little queasy. And the really good answer is to say, thanks, you look great for your age too. And then they'll say anything. And then that person, what you want to do is just sort of put it in a gentle way back on that person to try and think about why that didn't feel good. and why it doesn't. So if someone says something ageist, I have a much older friend who said, you know, someone said, why, I can't believe you're still up and around. Now, what the hell is she supposed to say in answer to that? You say, why would you say that?
Right, right. Yeah, no, there's so many things like that. I catch myself saying that. Oh, my God.
And things. Just, you know, just put it back on the person so that he or she has to think about why she would assume that, and then it's no more okay to say that than a question on the basis of your sexual orientation or your race or your size. It's not okay. I mean, people say horrible things about older people all the time. We say them ourselves.
Yeah,
and
we do.
We need to stop. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I was going through your website because it's so chock full. Because you're a journalist, you have a great base for wonderful content, and you also created consciousness-raising tools for people who may want to incorporate this into maybe they have a book club or some other book that's already put together, and you might want to incorporate these kind of consciousness-raising guidelines and tools to be able to bring this issue up and talk about it in a way that's open and very interesting. You have, you know, over 20 or 30 different questions that would elicit a great conversation. So
I've been in a group. It's called Who Me Ageist, and it's available for download for free on my homepage, which is thisjerrocks.com. For anyone who thinks like, oh my God, this woman's trying to change the world. She's delusional. I urge you to think about about the position of women in society 50 years ago, right? When we were still called girls and when we were thought incapable of really being executives or being physicians or, you know, having real power in the world. Look how far we've come. And
the
primary tool of the women's movement was consciousness raising, which really means just discussing your experiences in case of like being a woman, where your frustrations and sense of limitations come from. Because once you compare experiences, and that's what this guide has, a framework that you can follow or not follow, it's just suggestions. Once you're talking with your other friends about how you experience age, the amazing thing that happens is you start to say, whoa, you know, it's not my fault that I have wrinkles or that I got laid, you know, that I can't get a job interview. This is a widely shared problem that is political. And the solution to the problem is political and requires group action, right? We blame ourselves because we come from a society where we're supposed to be ashamed of aging instead of proud of it. And aging is an accomplishment. We tend to think, oh, it's my fault, right? It's not our fault any more than it's, I mean, if you think about, you know, think about homosexuality. It's not loving another man that makes life hard for gay guys. It's homophobia. And
right.
It's not being female. It's not having a vagina that's the problem. It's having people think that because I have a vagina, I'm less competent. It's discrimination. And the same around age. These things that make us feel somehow lesser or inferior are the result of discrimination, not aging. Discrimination is the problem, not aging. Aging means living. And we got to embrace it because
it's happening.
It's happening, and it's fantastic. You know, I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, if you're not aging, you know, I don't like this phrase successful aging because I think there's a very strong class bias. You know, you're supposed to be out, you know, surfing and skydiving and stuff, and not everyone can do that, to say the least, and not everyone wants to do it.
Right.
If you get up every day and pour yourself a bowl of cereal, you're aging successfully, and more power to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, so, you know, aging, it's self-determination. It's what you would do at any age. It's not just because you're older.
Well, yes and no, because there are huge social forces at work that make it harder than it should be, right?
Yeah. Yeah, if you want, for example, working, if you'd like to get a job and you're 63 years old and you really want to work for that company because they have benefits and it's going
to
be, I mean, there's the gap, right, before Medicare.
Yeah. But you bring experience and knowledge to the table. But the reason you're not getting that job, unless, I mean, you do need to keep your software skills up to date. You know, we can't blame things on aging that are our own responsibility. But on the other hand, the probable reason you can't even get an interview is because of structural discrimination in society. Not because you're old, right? And not because you're stupid, and not because you can't run some fancy-ass software program, you know, but because you are discriminated against before you even get your foot in the door. And that's why we need a mass movement against ageism, the way the women's movement brought about, you know, wide-scale social and political change that enabled women to become, you know, to achieve really full citizenship. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about citizenship.
And I guess this is even harder in the States than it is in other countries, because in other countries there is more, there's not so much a youth-obsessed culture. Thinking of, you know, I mean, you know, we're all...
Hollywood is the worst. I mean, there's, you know, Hollywood is certainly the epicenter of youth culture. The other is this extreme, extreme commercialism in America. And if you think about where these messages come from, that either aging is a disease that needs to be cured or aging is a problem that needs to be fixed, like those unsightly neck wrinkles or whatever, those messages come from people trying to sell you things. If we, you know, sell, you can't, if you're satisfied with your situation, there's no remedy that can be commercialized. And we see this a lot in the medicalization of old age. You know, all these medical terms for perimenopause and mild cognitive impairment and stuff, which is honestly just the normal process of physical aging. And the minute they decide it's a disease, then they can sell you a remedy. And if aging is a disease, everyone is going to come down with it. So what a market. And the same with the fact that if wrinkles are a problem, you know, why? Think for a minute about who decided that wrinkles were ugly. Right? That's just an arbitrary aesthetic judgment.
Right, exactly. It's seeing the opposite of pushing.
It should be beautiful. It should be like cracks on, you know, on beautiful glaze on porcelain or on beautiful old pieces of furniture. They're gorgeous, and they are the mess of our lives. And I don't know about you, but when I see these, you know, Botoxed faces that become these masks, I mean, aside from the point that sooner or later it's not going to work anymore, all that energy we spend pretending we can stop the clock is not healthy. It's a waste of time. It's a denial of something powerful and beautiful, and we'll be a lot better off putting our energy into embracing aging and combating the discrimination that makes it so much harder than it has to be, in America in particular, as you said.
Yeah, I feel like it is an American thing. I mean, one of the things that I've started to do, I really want to take art and kind of bring this, you talk about consciousness raising groups, and I think that's absolutely key. And one of the things I think that I'd like to do personally is become more involved in art and using art as a way to express this whole, express the social movement, but also just express the beauty of aging. And
that's a great idea. And
we've had more images like that, you know?
There's a big movement that's gaining more funding because the science behind it is getting more substantial, that shows that engagement in the arts is a fantastic way for older people to stay physically and cognitively engaged and present and healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen
not
that.
Surprising,
with my,
right?
Yeah, no, it's so true. I had my mother-in-law recently passed, but she was 89 years old, and for the last 30 years of her life, she had been engaged as an artist. So, you know, relatively late in life artist, but really, really engaged, and produced hundreds of beautiful works that ended up in local museums.
Yeah,
and
well, there are lots of
commission.
Grandma Moses is the classic example of. So I think she started painting in her 80s, but you know, Matisse. J.W. Turner, you know, it's not surprising, and there is often a creative sort of a liberation that enables people to who perhaps were reluctant to make art before they got very old, or liberates them to make art in a different way. That is a widely spread and widely studied phenomenon because it helps people stay engaged in the world and be able to share
what they do, right? It's a sharing, and have other people involved in, you know, not just looking at it, but talking about it or commissioning something and exhibiting. And I really think that's, you know, the arts are, as you mentioned, a way for as you age to really stay engaged and feel purposeful and produce something. I think one of the words I've been using a lot lately is productive. Like, how to remain productive.
Well,
but maybe that's only good for certain people.
Here's the thing about productivity is that in a capitalist society that's very commodified, like the United States, a sort of overarching reason that very young people and very old people aren't valued is because we tend to value people in terms of conventional economic productivity. And it's, you see, a little bit the Protestant ethic has a part to play in here. We see this huge emphasis on being busy, as though you
right.
have to be constantly engaged in order to be a valuable person. And, you know, I'm one of those people, I can't imagine not being on the hamster wheel till I, you know, till the day I die and fall off the hamster wheel. But that isn't, you know, it's partly a function of my personality, but it's also the way I've been conditioned. And not, first, two very important points. Not everyone is able to be
right.
conventionally economically productive, period. And they have equal value as human beings, right?
Right. No,
you know,
I've been thinking about that, you know, that the productivity comes from the capitalistic and the economic
and,
you know, ways that we've
we
been
need to, we need to also revise our way of assessing productivity. So I think, you know, and I don't think you and I are actually in disagreement here, if all I can do, in quotes, at 88 is to walk over and see if my 92-year-old or maybe my 19-year-old neighbor, you know, maybe she broke her leg skiing, you know. If older people do it, they put in much more time actually caring for someone else than the younger people do, if you look at, you know, statistics. And that work goes unpaid because as a society, we don't value caregiving. And P.S., guess who does most of this work? Women. And guess how much of it is paid? Almost none. So it's
right.
also, you know,
right.
women.
Oh,
issue.
It's so unbelievable.
Is that productive? I would argue absolutely it's productive. You know, if what you do is keep the median strip clear of trash or volunteer at, you know, volunteer work. We don't think volunteer work has value. Well, it has enormous
right.
social value. Early on, you said ageism is bad for society. It is bad for society because it pits us against each other, old versus
right.
young. The thing you hear all the time is like, those old people better get out of the way and give the jobs up to young people. 2 points there. How are older people supposed to be self-sufficient if we're denied access to the job market? But secondly, another myth. It's called the fallacy of the lump of labor. Google it. It is not true that older people take jobs away from younger ones because typically they have different experience and are competing for different jobs. It is strictly true that if there's a, you know, if the job market is super tight and there's only a fixed number of jobs, only a fixed number of people can get them. But that's not a too many old people problem. That's a labor market problem.
Yeah. No, that's clearly it's a pitting of us versus them because we're so quick
exactly.
to do that.
And you see it, you know, you see it throughout history. You see it and the media loves these battles because it's conflict and that gets. But like
yeah.
stay-at-home moms versus working moms, that's
right.
a bad fight to pick. Let's all mobilize together for an equal wage with men. You know.
Oh,
Polish,
yeah.
Polish factory workers against African-American factory workers at the turn of the century. As long as they were fighting each other, management could continue to exploit both of them. Hello, labor unions now being gutted. But, you know, that's what
right.
the labor union was created to combat. So that's what we need to come together. People of all ages, everyone is aging. And what we want,
right.
you know,
multi-generational.
We've got to age equality. Let's get to age equality. You know,
age equality, right? That's a
yeah.
It's enlightening the way that you're thinking about it, the way you're framing it, the language you're using. It's so. I think people think about it in little bits and pieces, but they don't. They don't actually. It's not internalized yet. So I do think that those the idea of social of consciousness raising is the. Is kind of a pathway forward for people who want to take something.
And I will just say, for anyone who wants to learn more about this, I did spend the last few years writing a book. It's called This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. And if you go to my homepage, which is thischairrocks.com, at the bottom of the homepage, you can sign up for my email. I will never give the email away. I promise I won't pester you with emails because I don't get it together to write them that often. But if you sign up for my email, you will know when the book becomes available. It has every idea you have heard now and many more in accessible, readable format, and it will change the way you think about the rest of your life.
That's awesome. Ashton, thank you so much for joining us. And everybody, to repeat, that's thischairrocks.com, where you can find Ashton's new book. And if you're interested in doing a social, and creating a social movement or your own consciousness raising group, feel free. There's also that information on our website. And drop me a line too, Kelly Connors at AOL.com. I'm using my AOL for this, Kelly Connors at AOL.com. And I'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas for future radio shows on this topic, because I think it's important and we need
It's important.
It's got to infiltrate our language and the way that we think much more. So future generations, if not ours, in the future, but we got to start now. So the time is now. Ashton, thank you so much, and I would love to stay in touch. I'll definitely grab your book.
That would be great.
And let's stay in touch, because I'd like to be part of this whole movement. Thank you so much.
Me too. All right.
Okay. We'll talk
soon.
Bye-bye.
Great.
Thanks for
Bye.
Listening to Real Women on Health and our series, Design the Second Half of Your Life. For more radio shows, stay tuned here on Blog Talk Radio, and we have them frequently, probably at this point it's 2 a month that we're doing, but you can always, again, email me, kellyconnors@AOL.com, for more information. Thanks so much. Till then, bye-bye.